The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic of today is thinking. And I enter this topic as with some care, some reverence for each of you, that when we start talking about thinking and mindfulness of thinking, it's easy for it to touch into something that's very intimate or very personal in people's lives. Sometimes thinking is just pure nonsense, but sometimes it's it connects into something profound within us or deep needs we have and connected to our life story and history in many ways that if we start looking at thoughts, we start kind of touching into something. And so to look at, to be aware of thinking and be mindful of thinking is a very important part of this whole practice. And for some people, it's really key. It's really the kind of one of the doors towards becoming freer and wiser and more present in their lives. So having said that as introduction, what I'd like to do is to tell you a little kind of analogy that I was told this last week. And I'll tell it to you the way I was told, and then I'll change it slightly. Because it has to do with monkeys. And monkeys sometimes get, used not in always great ways in these stories. Because in Buddhism, they have this idea in Buddhism of the monkey mind. And the monkey mind is the mind that, apparently monkeys, when they swing from tree to tree, branch to branch, the idea is that they will grab a branch, they'll swing and grab a branch, and just as they're grabbing that branch, they're already getting ready to grab the next branch. And it just goes on and on. So monkey mind is our mind, just by the time we have one thought, we're already grabbing for the next one. We're just swinging between them. So in this analogy, there is six monkeys that are living in a house. And one of them is sitting deep in the living room in a nice chair. And the other five are at the window looking out. And one of them says, "Look, there's this nice red car driving by." And so the one sitting in the chair hears that and says, "I want that." Another one is by the window and hears music down the street and says, "Oh, there's nice music down the street." And the one in the chair says, "I want that." Another one by the window smells the neighbor's septic system and says, "There's a not very pleasant smell." And the one sitting in the chair who doesn't smell it but hears that report gets all upset, that neighbor, and it's always neighbor, is always doing things wrong, and this is the worst neighbor. So it goes. And so this analogy is supposed to be a metaphor, analogy for six different aspects of how we live in the world. So we see the red car, we hear, we smell, I didn't do taste because I don't know how these monkeys taste what's going on out there, but the taste, and also we have tactile senses, we do. And these report to the mind, the experiences we're having. And the mind by itself is in the dark. But because it's reported, it gets these reports from the senses, it finds out what's going on. So it's kind of like deep in the living room in its easy chair. And then it reacts. It wants, it doesn't want, upset, it's delighted, it starts making stories, it reviews, it thinks about things. The neighbor who has this septic tank, You know, remembering all the different things that the neighbor did that was wrong over the years. You kind of go through the, you know, endless list. That's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. Or all the things, goes through and thinks about all the things it wants. You know, not only a red car, but a blue car and a pink car. And, you know, having lots of cars would be great. And just whatever, just kind of spinning its wheels in the mind. So that was the analogy that was given to me today, this last week. And rather than saying monkeys, I kind of think of it more as six children. And, you know, five by the window who report to the one who's not by the window, but the one who's not by the window hears reports and spins a whole cognitive universe and reactions and thoughts based on what it hears. And the reason that why I like to use the word children is that children can grow up. And also the idea, there is a parent in the house. And the idea is for the parent to show up and bring some wisdom to bear in the situation, and so the child can grow up. So in our minds, we think. And thinking is supported by what the sense doors provide us. And and there's different kinds of thinking. So as we begin this exploration of thinking, I think we want to look at the different kinds of thinking that we do. And you might see if you recognize any of this in yourself. On a very general level, there are two kinds of thinking. And some people do both. But there's people. Some people think in words, some people think in images. And not one's not better than the other, just how different minds work. But some people haven't really recognized that this is what they do. The people who think in words, thinking takes a different particular shape, it operates somehow in the mind differently than the people who have images. And so to recognize, you know, what kind of thinker you are, you can maybe start recognizing what are the impact of the images you have? How do they work? What's the emotional impact? Or how do you participate in them? And how are you a player in them? If you think in words, then same thing. You can kind of, whose voice is it? Who's the one who's thinking? What's the tone of voice? There's a lot of things can be seen in the voice that's doing the thinking. Either way, as we think, there are different levels of thinking. And one level is the one that's most active and busy, that sometimes is called discursive thinking. And that's when we think and we have conversations. Sometimes we actually have a conversation with other people, or we're seeing a vision of people having a conversation and talking to each other. Or we're having commentary. So it's discursive is you know, discussing something in your mind. So it could be commentary. It could be that you're reflecting on something. You have to plan something, and you're looking at all the things that have to do with the plans, imagining and thinking about all the things that can go wrong, and why this is a bad idea, and why you can't do it, and you're, you know. Or it could be that you're discussing what happened in the past, and you're reviewing the past and going over it and over it and over again. And it's amazing sometimes how repetitive discursive thinking can be. Then there's a simpler layer of thinking, which is very simple recognition of what's happening in the moment. So we could have recognition, oh, there's a cell phone that rang. It's very simple. That's it. Discursive thinking is where we get much more involved, and we have this means something, and why don't they have more policies here, or, you know, or this is great sound, I wonder I can get that sound from my phone. And so this idea of it can be very simple and kind of neutral. Oh, the ring of a cell phone. Just that neutral. That's a kind of thought that exists. And it's a kind of a sentence there. It's like a number of things that come together. And it is a kind of cognitive move. Some people won't recognize it as a thought, as a moment of cognition, but there is kind of thinking because we're relying on concepts that we've learned growing up. 1,000 years ago, someone would have heard that sound, and I don't know what they would have thought. They probably would have thought it was a bird, you know, and looked around for the bird and feathers or something. But we've learned that we associate that sound to a certain technological gadget, and so we cognize that's what it is. So kind of simple thinking. And then there's even a simpler layer of thinking, which is not cognizing, conceptualizing what it is, but just being, that's a sound. You know, hearing. Ringing. And it's that simple. The mind hears the ring, and it doesn't even go up to the next layer. That's a ringing phone. So these are different layers. There's other layers, but that's what kind of the three I wanted to highlight. And most people live in the layer of discursive thinking. Wisdom begins to operate when we cannot be caught in this, caught up in discursive thinking. Discursive thinking, thinking, analyzing, contemplating is an important part of human life. But eating is an important part of human life. But you're not expected to be eating all the time. Discursive thinking, contemplating, reflecting is an important part of human life. But if that's all you do, if that's the only vehicle by which you understand yourself and your life, it's actually quite truncated, quite limited. So one of the first tasks in mindfulness is to start appreciating the kinds of thinking that are operating in you. And to realize there are different capacities, different ways of thinking, cognizing our experience. In meditation, people can learn how rewarding or how satisfying it is to cease all the discursive thinking, to stop all the kind of distracted thoughts, imaginary thoughts, thinking about the future, thinking about the past, figuring things out. And how peaceful it is to settle down to just a simple recognition. Oh, there's a sound. There's a sound of a car. You know, just very simple. Here's a thought. Here's an itch. And part of the reason it feels so satisfying is that with discursive thinking, we tend to get involved with it. We get involved with energetically. We get involved emotionally. There's reactions. The world tends to get more limited and narrow and contracted the more tightly we're wrapped up around our discursive thoughts. As we begin to free ourselves from this strong gravitational pull into discursive thinking, the mind tends to have more space, more open. And the feeling of spaciousness, openness, ease, peace, of thought just kind of being there without any hook to them, just very simple, a thought arises, an idea arises, a memory arises, but nothing's done with it. We don't pick it up, we don't react to it, we don't make conclusions about it. It's just there. And in that simplicity, there's a lot of ease, much more satisfying. And it's also, then we see more clearly actually what's going on. So to want something, to want the red car, to have a thought, I want a red car. And if the next thing you know, you're at the car dealer buying a red car, and you didn't see anything in between, you don't remember what happened in between, you know, then the discursive world and this desire has kind of took over. But if you sat there and saw that desiring a red car bubble up in the mind, and you recognize it, there's a thought of desiring, a thought of red cars. In that simple layer of just recognizing what it is, there can be much more space to leave it alone, to not get involved. And then the wisdom of the mind can operate, and there can be a recognition in the mind, you know, I don't need to have a red car. I have a perfectly good car. I bet the desire for the red car had more to do with not the red car, but something else about it. So to simplify that, to be able to kind of be in recognizing. And that's where the parent comes in, or that's where the growing up can start happening, is if we can begin to say, oh, name it and see, that's what's happening now. That's what's happening now. That's what's happening now. And that's a hard skill to learn because of the tremendous way that we've pulled into discursive thinking. If for some people, if you look at your mind churning away in its thoughts and concerns, you can ask yourself, how much authority are you giving your thoughts? Or how much authority are they claiming? That this is important, this is true, this is the place to be with your life energy right now is to be with these thoughts. How much do you invest in your thoughts, in your discursive thinking and thinking about things? Invest because we often have sometimes a sense of promise in these thoughts. And so we're chasing that sense of promise or hope. How much credence do we give to the worry that's part of the thinking, the fear? And we really believe that fear and the worry that's there. This is a very important issue to look at how we relate to our thinking, our discursive thoughts, because there are some psychologists who think that some of the leading causes for things like depression, anxiety, despair for many people has to do with the nature of their thinking, the discursive thoughts. And the kind of, I think this, some people use the language of rumination. The ruminating over and over again over something. And to start putting a question mark after our rumination, our thoughts. Just enough, like, what is this? Rather than being swept along by them, what is this? Is this true? Do I need to be doing this? Is it useful to do this? Are there other perspectives in this? Psychologists call rumination, associate rumination, a lot with thinking a lot about the problems. What's the problems with me? What's the problem, what's going on? What's the problems with what happened? And there's a negative bias that psychologists think in what they call rumination. Many people have strong negative biases, and so they're often looking and ruminating and thinking about, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? That I'm somehow wrong, I'm a loser, I failed, or I can't really do something. And so when the rumination, when the thinking, the discursive thinking is circulating and repeating over and over and over again these kinds of thoughts, it's very debilitating. No wonder our whole system kind of starts to be drained and struggles. Also, our emotional life comes into play with all this. So these negative kind of thoughts are disturbing or emotionally, depressing in itself or sad or we get angry. And then it becomes this feedback loop between the negative emotions and the negative thoughts. And if we think that these thoughts are true or important or necessary to have, without any questioning them, without any, kind of stepping back. And so in mindfulness practice, the parental thing to do, if you go along with my little thing about the six children, is to be able to step out of the orbit of discursive thinking just enough to recognize, I'm having discursive thought. That's what's happening. And to do that with enough strength, enough clarity, that it's kind of like the adult part of our brain has showed up. Oh, that's what's happening. And then beginning to find a way to make that clear recognition. Oh, I'm having thoughts. That place where we recognize it, the mind that recognizes, is a mind which is not wrapped up in the thoughts. The mind that's not wrapped up or excessively influenced by the mood that's present. So, oh, here is depression. Here is worry. Here's thinking about the future, problem solving about things which are important, but very uncertain. Can't know how they're going to turn out, can't know what the right thing is. And so there's a strong kind of pull to be thinking and thinking about it over and over again because it's so uncertain and the consequences are so great. But it's more rumination, it's more kind of spinning. But what about that place, the adult-like place where you step back, oh, I'm worrying, I'm problem-solving, that's what's happening. Or I'm fantasizing of how great it's going to be. Some people have a wonderful discursive thoughts they get pulled into is the delight of anticipation. And I've known people who their primary joy, or a primary joy, is anticipating things are going to happen. And I've known people for whom actually doing them was less pleasant than anticipating doing them. Because then you anticipate it in just a fantasy way. It can all go perfect. And you can kind of savor the hope and the promise. But once it happens sometimes, you know, it's kind of like we're busy in the middle of it or distracted or it happens so fast or it's complicated or something. And so it's nice, you know, anticipatory delight in thinking is nice. It's not, you know, it's not a sin to do it. But it is kind of reinforcing this kind of place of being caught up in this discursive world. There is another world. There is another world of thinking to be in that I'm emphasizing as a place where wisdom can begin to operate. And I say that because the promise of discursive thinking is to solve and fix. But maybe there's another avenue, another place in the mind, in the heart, where solutions can come, responses can come. And this is a place where that is not wrapped up or not caught in the reactivity, what's going up, where the thinking is not mixed up with fear or worry or negative bias. So the simple act, you know, it's so simple to describe it, but difficult to do. The simple act of mindfulness is to take a moment and to recognize clearly at this moment, this is what's happening. At this moment, I'm sitting here in a chair. At this moment, sitting in a chair on my cushion, I feel the weight of my body against the chair. At this moment, I'm aware of the temperature of my body. That's simple, as opposed to, you know, composing a letter to the president of IMC about how we should have the air conditioner on more. This is what it's that's warm, just warm. It's just a simple recognition. And right now, I'm having thoughts. I'm thinking about this talk and what Gil is saying. Or I haven't been listening at all to what Gil's saying. I'm thinking about, you know, something else. Now I'm thinking about air conditioners. So it's that simple. It's that simple. And it can be very difficult for this mind of ours to be convinced that it's valuable to be that simple with the act of mindfulness because of the authority, the investment that we're entangled with all the thinking we have to do. But when we make that simple mindfulness act to recognize what's happening, we're beginning to step out of the gravitational pull of discursive thoughts. So there's more space. There's more space in the heart and the mind for more ways in which the mind and the heart operate to inform how we understand what's going on and what goes on. We start freeing ourselves from it a little bit. So recognizing what's happening. So it's not easy to do this, and sometimes this simple recognition is not enough. So in the Buddhist tradition, there's a number of recommendations of things to do besides just mindfulness. One is to focus on something different that's more useful to focus on. So one of the things that's, for some people, classic in meditation, is to focus on the breathing. The breathing is connected to something very profound within us. It's a very valuable connection to, way to connect to ourselves, is to be with our breathing. It's not obvious when we first start, but if you get into it, the breathing opens up to a wealth of treasures inside. And so to begin tuning into the breathing and trying to come back to the breath, rather than spinning out in our thoughts, is a very powerful thing to do. It takes a while, but every moment, every time, you take your attention and bring it back to your breathing. Bring it back to your breathing. Some of the energy of the mind is no longer going in to feed the discursive thought. And the amount of difference and change is very small initially. But if you take drops of water and drop it into a bathtub, eventually the bathtub will be filled. But each drop is inconsequential. So just keep coming back to your breathing. Slowly, slowly, it begins to decrease the amount of energy that's going into discursive thoughts. The other thing that is skillful to pay attention to is something which is not discursive thinking, but which is enjoyable and pleasant. So for some people who get into the focusing on the breathing becomes pleasant. And so to use that pleasure with the breathing as a place to ground the attention, so we're not so easily seduced by the thoughts that we have. Sometimes other things are more skillful to pay attention to the breath. Some people find loving kindness meditation is good. In daily life, it might be to look around if you're in a nice setting and see if you can look around and see if you see any nice trees, or do you hear birds, or are there nice people around, or are there, you know, something that's enjoyable in the environment right now, as opposed to spinning in discursive thoughts that have nothing to do with what's happening here and now. So just begin focusing on something nice and pleasant. If the discursive thoughts are really strong, then the recommendation is you actually distract yourself, which is what people do, kind of. Some people are experts at this distraction thing. But we're not distracting ourselves to escape. We're just distracting ourselves to begin to shift the inner life enough so we can start showing up here. So there's skillful distractions if it's really helpful. But it's not to run away from something. So, you know, go for a run or find a friend to talk to or read a book or do something that, cook a meal or do something for you, which kind of takes you out of the gravitational force of this spinning thoughts and rumination that's going on. The other thing that we do in meditation that's... meditation is kind of like a laboratory or a gym or something where you can kind of learn how to work with your mind. And then once you've learned how to work with it, you can start working with it outside meditation. So one of the things that we can learn as we sit and meditate is that when thinking is strong, we can feel what I call the thinking muscle. And the thinking muscle is that place in the body where there's tension associated with thinking. So there's pressure, there's tightness, there's constriction, there's forcefulness, there's a lot of energy swirling around. And the more strong we're thinking, the more likely, if you sit back and start looking at the physical sensations associated with thinking, you start feeling something. And you certainly see it in other people sometimes. You see someone suddenly starts to get really, they're preoccupied and thinking something really hard, and you see their forehead is furrowed, you see that their maybe their jaws are kind of grinding, you see perhaps that their shoulders are going up, or you know, all kinds of ways, physical things, you can feel the tension, you see it in people. The advantage of meditation is that sometimes you can feel that which is not visible to other people. There are more subtle ways in the things are operating. For some people, it's not uncommon to have the tension, pressure, be in the head someplace, kind of behind the forehead or in the forehead or around the eyes or different places. And so the advantage of feeling this thinking muscle, the sensations of tightness around thinking, is that then it's possible to, might be possible to relax it. To relax the thinking associated with, relax the tension associated with thinking. The advantage of doing this is that the tension associated with thinking, if it's still there, it's kind of like if you have a toothpaste, one of those tubes of toothpaste, and you stay squeezing it, for a long time the toothpaste just comes out and comes out and comes out. You have to stop squeezing it. So if we have this physical, emotional tension associated with thinking, the toothpaste comes out. The thought just keeps coming and coming and coming. And you can let go of your thinking momentarily, but if the tension is there, you'll think again. So part of this mindfulness is to not only be aware that we're thinking, but be aware of something about the physically what's happening as we think. Emotionally, what's happening as we think. And also, what is the relationship we have with our thinking? And, you know, so I think many people have never occurred to them that they have a relationship to their thinking. Some people are so embedded in their thinking, so connected, so involved with their thinking, that it's kind of like they are their thinking. It's kind of like thinking is the way we think about things, and there's no need to think about thinking. There's no need to look at thinking because that's just, I mean, how often, unless you have problems with your eyes, ordinarily as we go around in our world, we're not so cognizant of the eyes doing the looking, even though we are using them. So in the same way with thinking, we don't really look at our thinking or question it and ask, you know, what is my relationship to this thinking? And the relationship is kind of subtle. What's the attitude I have to my thinking? The attitude can be one of despair. Just depression. Just kind of like, oh, once more I'm thinking this thing. And so the attitude can be one of hope. If I just think enough, there's got to be a solution there. There could be one of strong identification. A lot of thoughts have to do with me, myself, and mine. So it's all about me. I'm the main character of my thoughts. So there's a lot of investment of I. The whole kind of phenomenon of I comes into play. So thinking can be, it's a rich, rich world, the world of thinking. And the way to begin having a different relationship to discursive thoughts, the way to bring the parent into the room, or the way to let this thinking grow up, become more mature, in the mindfulness practice, is to start doing the very simple act of recognizing, I'm thinking. But maybe you need to say it again. Like, I am thinking. Yep, I am thinking. No question about it. As opposed to, I'm thinking, and then running off in thought again. But really kind of step back and this is a thought. This is the mind thinking. Here is a mind caught up in its discursive thought. This is thinking. And I'm repeating this because the idea is to do it often enough and clear enough, you know, that at some point you're a little bit standing away from the thoughts. You're not wedded to it or caught in it. You're a little bit kind of observing it from a relaxed, mature place in the mind. You all have a mature adult in your mind that I would suggest kind of to be provocative, to get your attention. You don't use often enough. And if you can step back and clearly recognize what's happening from a place of recognition that is not caught in the experience at the moment, you recognize it with a place of balance, a place of non-reactivity, just simply, oh, this is what's happening, then the mature part of you will begin to grow and have a chance to show up, and there'll be an adult in the room. Something like that. So I'll end with another story. Famous, often repeated story, but I think it's good to be reminded of it. It comes from the Chinese Buddhist tradition. Two Chinese Buddhist monks were traveling on a journey across the countryside from one monastery to another. And halfway through the day, they came to a river crossing, and there was a woman who couldn't quite make it across the river. And so, but she needed to get across. So one of the monks wanted to help, so the monks picked her up and carried her across and put her down the other side. And then the two monks continued to the monastery, they stopped for the evening. As they came to the monastery door, gate, the second one finally blurted out, "How could you have done that? You know that we, as Buddhist monks, we are not allowed to physically touch a woman. How could you have touched her and picked her up and carried her across the river? And you broke the rules, and this is, you know, how could you?" And then the first monk said, "You know, I put the woman down back at the river. Why are you still carrying her?" So, maybe you don't have to carry as much as you do. Or maybe you can put some of the stuff down long enough that you can see it from a different perspective. And one of the perspectives is points to freedom and delight. And one of the results for me from doing this mindfulness practice in relation to my thinking is nowadays I feel my thinking is my friend. And I have a very friendly relationship with my thoughts. We get along pretty well. And generally, I'm in charge, not my thoughts. So may you be friendly with your thoughts, and may they become your friends as well.